Welcome to Prima's 2023 podcast series. My name is Shonda Ragland. I am the Senior Director of Education and Training at Prima. On this Prima podcast, Shonda Vry will discuss capital projects planning. Shonda is the public entity practice leader at Propel Insurance. We will also be joined by Prima's Education Coordinator, Taekwon Gilbert. Taekwon will moderate the discussion. Enjoy the podcast.
Thank you for joining us today, Sean.
Happy to be here.
So to start, when should public agencies begin budgeting for insurance on their capital projects?
Well, the simple answer to that question is as soon as they have an approved budget and a project plan, they should start thinking about insurance. And I guess the reason for that is that we're in a very volatile insurance marketplace now, particularly for project insurances. And it's going to move probably between the time their project is they've got an approved budget and the time they break ground on the project, the insurance costs may go up. So it's something that they should put into their initial project planning budget and update maybe even monthly, if not quarterly, during the planning phase of the project before they start construction.
Should public agencies rely on their construction contractors to provide adequate insurance for each construction project?
Well, I think the answer to that question is that it depends. So it really depends on the size and scope of the project. If it's a small project, maybe a repaving project on a street or something like that, maybe the answer is yes. Their contractors can provide adequate coverage for it. But if it's a large, critical project, maybe a one-time major capital project for a city or county or public agency, I'd recommend that they consider controlling the insurance themselves, or at least compare the alternatives of their contractor providing insurance and the public agency providing insurance as well. The reason for that is they can control the coverage structure. They can make sure that it's adequate for their project. They don't have to rely on their contractor if there's a claim. So the more complicated and complex and critical to the operation the project is, the more they should consider controlling the insurance themselves. Because if you work backwards from a claim, do they really want the contractor managing a claim on their most critical project they've ever built? Would it's going to impact their operation? The answer may be no to that question. So I think that's the frame within which the public agency should consider this question.
When does it make sense for a public agency to consider placing builder's risk insurance on a capital project?
Well, the contractors generally may offer coverage. Some contractors have master builder's risk programs in place for all of their large projects. Some don't. So if a contractor was going to go out and place a one-off builder's risk policy, the cost would essentially be the same for the public agency, the owner of the project, to go off and place their own one-off builder's risk policy. And in fact, the terms and conditions would be quite similar. There's no difference between a builder's risk policy placed by a contractor and one placed by an owner in general terms. So to harken back to the question or the answer to the first question, which is if it's a critical project and the cost is about the same, why wouldn't they want to control the insurance themselves? So for larger, more complicated capital projects, I would recommend the public agency consider placing builder's risk, because if there's a claim, they'll be managing the claim. The other slight difference there is that contractors may, depending on the terms of the contract and the procurement laws in place, may have the ability to mark up the cost of the builder's risk premium. So theoretically, you might save that markup if the public agency does it themselves. You control the claim. So you reduce cost slightly, you control the terms and conditions of coverage, and you control the claim and the resolution to a claim. So I think it's important that it's a consideration for large, complex projects for the public agency to place the builders risk themselves and control those terms and conditions when it makes sense.
Should a public agency ensure general liability on its capital projects with an OCIP or CCIP? And what factors should be considered in evaluating each?
Similar to my response on builder's risk, an OCIP and a CCIP are essentially two versions of the same thing, an owner-controlled insurance program or a contractor-controlled insurance program. And it's a coverage form that protects all of the participants in a project, the general contractor, the owner, as well as all the subcontractors of every tier. And it can be used for general liability and excess liability and or workers' compensation. So for larger, more complicated projects, they can use an OCIP or CCIP for general liability, excess, and workers' comp, protecting all the parties that are working at that project site. So essentially, OCIP purchased by an owner is the same coverage structure as CSIP purchased by a contractor. So the factors they should consider there are scope and terms of coverage. If you have a contractor who has a rolling CSIP or a, you know, their own institutionalized CSIP that they use on every project or every large project they build, they may have better terms and conditions. They may have better pricing. They may have broader coverages, higher limits, and a CSIP might make sense there. Conversely, if you have an owner who has got a program of construction, say it's a, you know, sewer and water program where they're doing miles and miles of pipelines under several separate projects over a long period of time, you know, a capital program, then the owner might want to consider controlling it themselves because they essentially are going to have different contractors for multiple phases, different prime contractors for multiple phases of work. And if they normalize that insurance coverage, they can make sure that terms and conditions are designed to protect their risk specifically and by terms and limits that scale with their projects. So we'd generally recommend if it's a program of construction that the owner consider controlling it. If it's a one-off project with a sophisticated contractor who uses their own CSIP, then a CSIP probably makes sense. But comparing the two of those things should really be done at the project planning phase, early in the budgeting and planning phase of which option makes the most sense for the project. They're both adequate options. You know, I'm personally agnostic as to whether a CSIP or OSIP is better. Some people ask that question, but they're both essentially the same. It just depends on the type of project and the conditions of the project, which ones make the most sense.
Should workers' compensation be included in an OSIP or CSIP for large capital projects?
Well, that's a great question. And frankly, the marketplace for combined general liability work comp wrap-ups, OSIPs and CSIPs, really starts on projects that are probably larger than $500 million. Depends a little bit on the region. Some states in particular, like the state I reside in, Oregon, has a statutory requirement, a statutory minimum of $90 million for a program of construction before you can even consider including workers' compensation in a project. So it has to be a major project for workers' compensation to make sense. The other consideration, and I've dealt with this with lots of large public agencies, after having done $60 billion or so of projects over the last 20 years myself, you got to consider the tail. Workers' compensation claims tend to go for a while. And if you think of a claim that might have happened where a worker gets injured towards the end of the project, the owner probably wants to close the project budget. The public agency has a construction budget, whichever department it is that's building the asset, and they want to close that budget when the project's done. Unfortunately, if you take on workers' compensation with some level of a loss-sensitive insurance program structure, like a high deductible or a retrospectively rated program, that tail of workers' comp claims is going to extend beyond the completion of the project. So if you do insure workers' comp on a large project, you've got to think ahead about what to do with that liability that exists after the completion of the project. You can buy the claims out over time with most insurers and various program structures, but you still have to figure out where that goes. It could be in a risk management fund at the agency level, or it could be a specific fund developed only for that project and the residual claims. But it's something that really needs to be thought through and considered if they're going to include workers' compensation in an OSIP. If it's a CSIP doing workers' compensation, by the way, the contractor has that problem. Their contractor is going to be paying those tail claims, so the public agency shouldn't care as much in a CSIP, but they may have to address that contractually to make sure that none of those residual costs the contractor is going to incur for those claims would bleed back to the public agency. So it's the nuance in the writing of the contracts to make sure they protect themselves.
How will using an OSIP or CSIP impact supplier diversity and DE&I objectives?
Another very good question. And I think this is one of the benefits of using an OSIP for a public agency. CSIP may work similarly, but it really depends on the contractor because their contractor would be controlling it. But in an owner-controlled insurance program, an OSIP, public agencies often find that it supports better inclusion of small and minority contracting firms. And the reason for that is that on their, let's just call it traditional insurance for other projects, they have insurance minimums that have to be met by the prime contractor and the subs to participate in that project. And that those minimums are oftentimes a barrier for entry in smaller and emerging companies that may not have the assets that the bigger companies do. So it tends to open up the playing field to small and minority owned firms so that they can participate in the construction project, because insurance is not one of the barriers to entry and participation in the project. The other thing that we see in most OSIBs, you know, we work with our clients to develop an outreach program typically that helps those small and emerging companies that are maybe unfamiliar with participating in an OSIB, helps them learn how to participate, how to complete all the forms, how to report payrolls, et cetera. So it's an opportunity for public agencies to support their outreach to the minority contracting community through the insurance mechanism on a large complex project. So I guess the answer to the question in short is that it is a positive impact on supplier diversity and DE&I objectives for a large construction project. It's something that should be considered because of that.
How should a public agency address pollution liability risks associated with capital construction projects?
Well, this is another depends the answer, I guess. And, you know, it depends a little bit on, depends entirely on the scope of the project. If there's any pollution conditions in existence prior to the start of the project, in other words, if they're redeveloping a brownfield, for instance, into the new city hall, it's a major consideration. Something that, and there's two components to it, really site-specific pollution coverages, like an environmental impairment liability policy, which would cover pollutants emanating from the site and going damaging third parties, howsoever caused, really, as a site-specific policy. I shouldn't say that. It's not that quite that broad of a trigger, but it's a broader trigger than a contractor's pollution liability policy or legal liability policy, which it's really only triggered by the acts of the contractor or by pollutants the contractor brings to the project site. So the first piece, the site-specific pollution policy, should be considered if there is any kind of contaminated soils at the project location. The second type should be considered really for all projects, because contractors bring pollutants to project sites. I've personally been involved in a claim where an interior carpentry subcontractor, which nobody thinks is a high risk of pollution liability, knocked over a drum of fuel next to an active waterway with a forklift while they were doing some work. And that was a pollution event. They damaged a third party, that waterway. So there was a major pollution cleanup effort. And thankfully, we had contractors' pollution liability in place for that project. So even though you may think a contractor isn't involved with managing contaminated materials, they still have pollution risk when they come to a job site. So contractors' pollution legal liability is an important coverage to consider really for just about every project of any size. And you can buy it on a wrap-up basis like an OSIP or CSIP, so it could cover all contractors participating in that project. That's one way that we've seen project owners effectively manage the cost, because the alternative is that you require everybody down the chain to supply the same insurance, and the cost of all those insurances for all the contractors kind of stack on top of each other. So it's a more expensive way to deliver that product. If you manage it yourself and buy it for everybody, it tends to be cheaper. So frankly, if it's a contaminated project site, we should definitely have some site-specific pollution and some contractors' pollution legal liability. If it is not a contaminated project site, they should still consider contractors' pollution legal liability at least for all of their contractors, and may require it by contract. So I hope that answers that question.
Thank you for that, Sean. Do you have any closing remarks?
Yeah, I do. I think the theme of the whole presentation here, or the discussion, is about planning for the insurance on major capital projects for public agencies. And I guess the point that I want to make sure is clear is that starting early and building that plan and building the costs associated with that plan is really important. It's definitely a best practice in capital project planning. The other point I guess I'd like to make is that there's no one way of doing it. The owner doesn't have to provide all the coverages for the project or the contractor. You can mix and match. The owner can provide some, the contractor provides some, just as long as you're covering all of the risks associated with that unique project and planning for how you want to manage those risks. So I think capital project risk management planning is a discipline that the most mature entities with the best practice environment spend a lot of time focusing on before they put a shovel in the ground to build a project. So I'd highly recommend that agencies of all sizes put some thought into insurance on their projects, even the small ones, because bad things can happen on small projects. So thinking ahead a little bit about how to best insure a project is something that they should work with their insurance professionals to achieve before they start the work and while they're planning the work. So thanks for the opportunity, and look forward to future discussions with Prima.
We've reached the end of our podcast. Thanks for tuning in. Please visit the Prima website to hear other Prima podcasts, view upcoming Prima webinars, read Prima blogs, and learn about other Prima educational resources. Be sure to check us out on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, and our very own Prima Talk. Have an amazing day.